Chapter 59. Behavior on the field. We drank my Lord Castlewood's health and majority, the 25th of September, the army being then before Mons. And here Colonel Esmond was not so fortunate, as he had been in actions much more dangerous, and was hit by a spent ball just above the place where his former wound was, which caused the old wound to open again, fever, spitting of blood, and other ugly symptoms to ensue, and, in a word, brought him near to death's door. The kind lad, his kinsman, attended his elder comrade with a very praiseworthy affectionateness and care until he was pronounced out of danger by the doctors, when Frank went off, passed the winter at Bruxelles, and besieged, no doubt, some other fortress there. Very few lads would have given up their pleasures so long and so gaily as Frank did. His cheerful prattle soothed many long days of Esmond's pain and languor. Frank was supposed to be still at his kinsman's bedside for a month after he had left it, for letters came from his mother at home full of thanks to the younger gentleman for his care of his elder brother. So it pleased Esmond's mistress now affectionately to style him, nor was Mr. Esmond in a hurry to undeceive her when the good young fellow was gone for his Christmas holiday. It was as pleasant to Esmond on his couch to watch the young man's pleasure at the idea of being free, as to note his simple efforts to disguise his satisfaction on going away. There are days when a flask of champagne at a cabaret, and a red-cheeked partner to share it, are too strong temptations for any young fellow of spirit. I am not going to play the moralist and cry, For ages past, I know how old men preach, and what young men practice, and that patriarchs have had their weak moments too, long since Father Noah toppled over after discovering the vine. Frank went off, then, to his pleasures at Bruxelles, in which capital many young fellows of our army declared they found infinitely greater diversion even than in London. And Mr. Henry Esmond remained in his sick room, where he read a fine comedy that his mistress pronounced to be sublime, and that was acted no less than 3 successive nights in London in the next year. Here, as he lay nursing himself, ubiquitous Mr. Holt reappeared, and stopped a whole month at Mons, where he not only won over Colonel Esmond to the king's side in politics, that side being always held by the Esmond family, but where he endeavored to reopen the controversial question between the churches once more, and to recall Esmond to that religion in which, in his infancy, he had been baptized. Holt was a casuist, both dexterous and learned, and presented the case between the English Church and his own in such a way that those who granted his premises ought certainly to allow his conclusions. He touched on Esmond's delicate state of health, chance of dissolution, and so forth, and enlarged upon the immense benefits that the sick man was likely to forego, benefits which the Church of England did not deny to those of the Roman Communion, as how should she, being derived from that Church, and only an offshoot from it? But Mr. Esmond said that his Church was the Church of his country, and to that he chose to remain faithful. Other people were welcome to worship, and to subscribe any other set of articles, whether at Rome or at Augsburg. But if the good father meant that Esmond should join the Roman Communion for fear of consequences, and that all England ran the risk of being damned for heresy, Esmond, for one, was perfectly willing to take his chance of the penalty along with the countless millions of his fellow countrymen, who were bred in the same faith, and along with some of the noblest, the truest, the purest, the wisest, the most pious, and learned men and women in the world. As for the political question, in that Mr. Esmond could agree with the father much more readily, and had come to the same conclusion, though, perhaps, by a different way. The right divine, about which Dr. Sacheverell and the High Church party in England were just now making a bother, they were welcome to hold as they chose. If Richard Cromwell, and his father before him, had been crowned and anointed, and bishops enough would have been found to do it, it seemed to Mr. Esmond that they would have had the right divine just as much as any Plantagenet, or Tudor, or Stuart. but the desire of the country, being unquestionably for an hereditary monarchy, Esmond thought an English king out of St. Germain's was better and fitter than a German prince from Herrenhausen, and that if he failed to satisfy the nation, some other Englishman might be found to take his place. And so, though with no frantic enthusiasm, or worship of that monstrous pedigree which the Tories chose to consider divine, he was ready to say, God save King James, when Queen Anne went the way of kings and commoners. I fear, Colonel, you are no better than a Republican at heart, says the priest with a sigh. I am an Englishman, says Harry, and take my country as I find her. The will of the nation, being for church and king, I am for church and king too, but English church and English king, and that is why your church isn't mine, though your king is. Though they lost the day at Malplaquet, it was the French who were elated by that action, whilst the conquerors were dispirited by it, and the enemy gathered together a larger army than ever, and made prodigious efforts for the next campaign. Marshal Berwick was with the French this year, and we heard that Marischal Villars was still suffering of his wound, was eager to bring our Duke to action, and vowed he would fight us in his coach. Young Castlewood came flying back from Bruxelles, as soon as he heard that fighting was to begin, and the arrival of the Chevalier de St. George was announced about May. 'Tis the King's third campaign, and it's mine, Frank liked saying. He was come back a greater Jacobite than ever, and Esmond suspected that some fair conspirators at Bruxelles had been inflaming the young man's ardor. Indeed, he owned that he had a message from the Queen, Beatrix's godmother, who had given her name to Frank's sister the year before he and his sovereign were born. However desirous Marshal Villars might be to fight, my Lord Duke did not seem disposed to indulge him this campaign. Last year his grace had been all for the Whigs and Hanoverians, but finding, on going to England, his country cold towards himself, and the people in a ferment of high church loyalty, the Duke comes back to his army cooled towards the Hanoverians, cautious with the imperialists, and particularly civil and polite towards the Chevalier de St. George. 'Tis certain that messengers and letters were continually passing between his grace and his brave nephew, the Duke of Berwick, in the opposite camp. No man's caresses were more opportune than his grace's, and no man ever uttered expressions of regard and affection more generously. He professed to Monsieur de Torcy, so Mr. St. John told the writer, quite an eagerness to be cut in pieces for the exiled queen and her family. Nay more, I believe, this year he parted with a portion of the most precious part of himself, his money which he sent over to the royal exiles. Mr. Tunstall, who was in the prince's service, was twice or thrice in and out of our camp, the French, in theirs of Arleu and about Arras. A little river, the Can I think 'twas called, but this is writ away from books and Europe, and the only map the writer hath of these scenes of his youth bears no mark of this little stream, divided our pickets from the enemies. Our sentries talked across the stream, when they could make themselves understood to each other, and when they could not, grinned, and handed each other their brandy flasks or their pouches of tobacco. And one fine day of June, riding thither with the officer who visited the outposts, Colonel Esmond was taking an airing on horseback, being too weak for military duty. They came to this river, where a number of English and Scots were assembled, talking to the good-natured enemy on the other side. Esmond was especially amused with the talk of one long fellow, with a great curling red mustache, and blue eyes, that was half a dozen inches taller than his swarthy little comrades on the French side of the stream, and being asked by the colonel, saluted him, and said that he belonged to the Royal Cravats. From his way of saying oil cravat, Esmond at once knew that the fellow's tongue had first wagged on the banks of the Liffey, and not the Loire, and the poor soldier a deserter probably did not like to venture very deep into French conversation, lest his unlucky brogue should peep out. He chose to restrict himself to such few expressions in the French language as he thought he had mastered easily, and his attempt at disguise was infinitely amusing. Mr. Esmond whistled Lillibullero, at which Teak's eyes began to twinkle, and then flung him a dollar, when the poor boy broke out with a, "Odd bless that is, Dieu benisse votre honor," that would infallibly have sent him to the provost marshal had he been on our side of the river. Whilst this parley was going on, three officers on horseback, on the French side, appeared at some little distance, and stopped as if eyeing us, when one of them left the other two, and rode close up to us who were by the stream. "Look, look," says the royal cravat, with great agitation, "Pas lui, that's he, not him, Lauder," and pointed to the distant officer on a chestnut horse, with a cuirass shining in the sun, and over it a broad blue ribbon. "Pleased to take Mr. Hamilton's services to my Lord Marlborough, my Lord Duke," says the gentleman in English. And, looking to see that the party were not hostilely disposed, he added, with a smile, "There's a friend of yours, gentlemen, yonder. He bids me to say that he saw some of your faces on the 11th of September last year." As the gentleman spoke, the other two officers rode up and came quite close. We knew at once who it was. It was the king, then 22 years old, tall and slim, with deep brown eyes that looked melancholy, though his lips wore a smile. We took off our hats and saluted him. No man, sure, could see for the first time, without emotion, the youthful inheritor of so much fame and misfortune. It seemed to Mr. Esmond that the prince was not unlike young Castlewood, whose age and figure he resembled. The Chevalier de St. George acknowledged the salute, and looked at us hard. Even the idlers on our side of the river set up a hurrah. As for the royal cravat, he ran to the prince's stirrup, knelt down and kissed his boot, and bawled and looked 100 ejaculations and blessings. The prince bade the aide-de-camp give him a piece of money, and when the party saluting us had ridden away, Cravat spat upon the piece of gold by way of benediction, and swaggered away, pouching his coin and twirling his honest carroty mustache. The officer in whose company Esmond was, the same little captain of Handyside's regiment, Mr. Stern, who had proposed the garden at Lille, when my Lord Mohun and Esmond had their affair, was an Irishman too, and as brave a little soul as ever wore a sword. "Bedded," says Roger Stern, "that long fellow spoke French, so beautiful that I shouldn't have known he wasn't a foreigner, till he broke out with his hullabalooing, and only an Irish calf can bellow like that." And Roger made another remark in his wild way, in which there was sense as well as absurdity, "If that young gentleman," says he, "would but ride over to our camp, instead of Villers, toss up his hat and say, 'Here am I, the king, who'll follow me?' Apostrophe apostrophe by the Lord, Esmond, the whole army would rise and carry him home again, and beat Villers, and take Paris by the way." The news of the prince's visit was all through the camp quickly, and scores of ours went down in hopes to see him. Major Hamilton, whom we had talked with, sent back by a trumpet several silver pieces for officers with us. Mr. Esmond received one of these, and that medal, and a recompense not uncommon amongst princes, were the only rewards he ever had from a royal person, whom he endeavored not very long after to serve. Esmond quitted the army almost immediately after this, following his general home, and, indeed, being advised to travel in the fine weather and attempt to take no further part in the campaign. But he heard from the army that of the many who crowded to see the Chevalier de St. George, Frank Castlewood had made himself most conspicuous. My Lord Viscount riding across the little stream bareheaded to where the prince was, and dismounting and kneeling before him to do him homage. Some said that the prince had actually knighted him, but my lord denied that statement, though he acknowledged the rest of the story, and said, "Rom having been out of favor with Corporal John, as he called the Duke, before his grace warned him not to commit those follies, and smiled on him cordially ever after. And he was so kind to me, Frank Ritt, that I thought I would put in a good word for Master Harry, but when I mentioned your name he looked as black as thunder, and said he had never heard of you." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.